Part 4. City Under the Ice. Chapter 32. April 10th, 2001. Buenos Aires, Argentina. Limousines formed a long arc on the circular drive of the British Embassy in Buenos Aires. Ladies in ball gowns and men in tuxedos exited the long black cars and entered through high bronze doors into the foyer, where they were met by the British ambassador to Argentina, Charles Lexington, and his wife Martha, a tall, serene woman with white hair cut in a page boy. The social event of the year was a celebration in honor of Prince Charles' elevation to the throne, finally abdicated by his mother, Queen Elizabeth. The elite of Argentina had been invited, and all attended. The president, the National Congress leaders, the mayor of the city, financiers and industrialists, and the nation's most admired celebrities. Those who entered the ballroom to the music of an orchestra in 18th-century costume were enthralled with the sumptuous buffet prepared by the finest chefs imported from England especially for the event. When Karl Wolf and his usual entourage of sisters made their grand entrance into the vast room, they inevitably received the stares of everyone present. His personal bodyguard stayed close beside them at all times. In keeping with their family tradition, the gorgeous women were all wearing gowns of the same design, but in different colors. After being greeted by the British ambassador, they swept into the ballroom, their radiance envied by most all the women present. Carl was accompanied by Gailey, Maria, and Lucy, who'd brought along their husbands, and Elsie, who had just returned from America. As his sisters and their spouses began dancing to a medley of Cole Porter tunes, Carl led Elsie to the buffet, stopping along the way to accept a glass of champagne from the liveried waiters. They selected a sampling of exotic dishes and moved into the library, where they found an empty table with two chairs next to a floor-to-ceiling bookcase. Elsie was about to lift a fork with a delicate cheese to her mouth when her hand froze in midair and her face took on a look of disbelief. Carl studied her dazed expression but did not turn around, instead waiting quietly for an explanation. It came with the presence of a tall, rugged-looking man with a lovely woman at his side, flaming red hair cascading to her waist. The man wore a tuxedo with a maroon brocade vest, and a gold watch chain hung across the front. The woman was dressed in a black silk velvet jacket over a slim-fitting black silk ankle-length gown slit on the sides. A crystal beaded choker adorned her slender neck. They approached the Wolfs and stopped. "How nice to see you again, Elsie," said Pitt cordially. Before she could answer, he turned to Wolf. "You must be the infamous Carl Wolf I've heard so much about." He paused and turned to Pat. "May I introduce Dr. Patricia O'Connell?" Wolf gazed at Pitt as a cutter might study a diamond before lifting his mallet to strike his wedge and cleave a stone. Though he didn't seem to recognize Pitt, Pat felt a chill ripple up her spine. The billionaire was extremely handsome, but he stared from eyes that were cold and threatening. There was a hardness about him that suggested an underlying savagery. If he knew who she was, he showed no sign of recognition at hearing her name, nor did he display gentlemanly grace by rising from his chair. "Though we have never met," Pitt continued in a friendly fashion, "I feel as if I know you." "I have no idea who you are," said Wolf in perfect English, with just a trace of a Teutonic accent. "My name is Dirk Pitt." For a brief moment, there was incomprehension in Wolf's eyes. Then his face slowly took on a look of pure animosity. "You are Dirk Pitt?" he asked coldly. "None other." He smiled at Elsie. You look surprised to see me. You left Washington quite suddenly before we had a chance to chat again. Where did you come from? She snarled. From the Ulrich Wolf, Pitt answered politely. After taking a tour of the ship, Pat and I found ourselves in Buenos Aires and thought we'd drop by and say hello. If her eyes were lasers, Pitt would have been fried and grilled. We can have you killed. You've tried, and it didn't work out, Pitt replied casually. I don't advise you to try again, certainly not inside the British Embassy in front of all these people. When you reach the street, Mr. Pitt, you will be in my country, not yours. You will be helpless to protect yourselves. Not a good idea, Carl. You'd only upset the United States Marines who escorted us here tonight under the protection of the American Ambassador, John Horn. One of Wolf's hefty bodyguards moved forward then, as if to assault Pitt. But suddenly Giordino stepped from behind and stood toe-to-toe with the guard, blocking any movement. The guard, who outweighed Giordino by a good 50 pounds and stood 10 inches taller, looked down contemptuously and said, "What makes you think you're so tough, little man?" Giordino grinned condescendingly. "Would you be impressed if I told you that I'd just exterminated half a dozen of your fellow vermin?" "He's not kidding," said Pitt. The guard's reaction was amusing. He didn't know whether to be mad or wary. Wolf raised a hand and idly waved off his bodyguard. "I congratulate all of you on your escape from the Ulrich Wolf. My security forces proved most incompetent." "Not at all," Pitt replied amicably. "They were really quite good. We were very lucky." "From the report I received, luck had very little to do with it." It was as close to a compliment as Carl Wolf could ever give. He came slowly out of his chair and stood facing Pitt. He was 2 inches taller and relished looking down at this thorn in Destiny Enterprises' side. His blue-gray eyes glinted, but their fixed stare was easily matched and returned by Pitt, who was more interested in studying his enemy than engaging in a childish game of stare-down. "You are making a regrettable mistake in opposing me, Mr. Pitt. Surely you must be aware by now that I am dedicated to using every tool at my command to make the world as pure and as uncontaminated as it was 9,000 years ago." "You have a strange way of going about it. Why did you come here tonight?" Pitt did not back off. "I have suffered a great deal of inconvenience because of your family, and I was determined to meet the man who's been scheming to play master of the universe."
"And now that you've met me?"
"It seems to me you've bet the farm on a phenomenon that may not take place. How can you be so dead certain the twin of the comet that wiped out the Amenes will return next month and strike the Earth? How do you know it won't miss, as it did then?" Wolf looked at Pitt speculatively and smiled maliciously. It was obvious that a man of his wealth and power was not used to people who did not fear him, who did not grovel in his divine presence. "The coming cataclysm is an established conclusion. The world, as it is known by every living creature, will no longer exist. With the exception of my family, everyone in this room, including yourself, will surely perish." He leaned forward with a wicked grin. "But I'm afraid, Mr. Pitt, that it will happen rather sooner than you think. The timetable's been advanced, you see. The end of the world will begin precisely 4 days and 10 hours from now."
Pitt tried to hide his shock.
"Less than 5 days? How was it possible?" Pat didn't bother to hide her dismay. "How could you do this? Why have you gone to so much trouble to keep it a secret?" she demanded impassionedly. "Why haven't you warned every living soul on Earth so they can prepare for whatever happens? Have you and your precious sisters no conscience?
Have you no compassion? Don't the deaths of billions of children torment you like any sane person? You're just as bad as your ancestors who slaughtered millions.
Elsie shot to her feet.
How dare you insult my brother, she hissed.
Pitt slid his arm around Pat's waist. Don't waste your breath on these purveyors of slime, he said, his face taut with anger. The confrontation was getting too tense. But he couldn't resist getting in one more remark. He looked at Elsie and said pleasantly, with a chilling grin,
You know, Elsie, I'll bet that making love to you and your sisters is like making love to ice sculptures.
Elsie hauled back to slap Pitt, but Pat lunged forward and grabbed her arm. Elsie snatched it away, shocked that someone other than a family member would treat her roughly. For a moment, both Pitt and Wolf thought the two women were going to go at it, but Pat smiled brazenly and turned to Pitt and Giordino.
I'm bored. Why don't one of you gentlemen ask me to dance?
Pitt decided it was wiser to hang around and attempt to milk the Wolfs for more information while he had their attention. He made a slight bow to Giordino.
You first.
My pleasure.
Giordino took Pat's hand and led her to the dance floor, where the orchestra was playing Cole Porter's Night and Day.
Pitt said to Carl Wolf,
Very clever of you, accelerating the schedule. How did you do it?
Ah, Mr. Pitt, Wolf said, I must have some secrets to myself.
Pitt tried a different tack.
I compliment you on your ships. They are masterworks of marine architecture and engineering. Only the Freedom, the sea city built by Norman Nixon of Engineering Solutions, comes close to matching their magnificent scale.
That is true.
Wolf was intrigued, despite himself. I freely admit that many of the qualities we built into the Ulrich Wolf came from those designs.
Do you really think those immense vessels will float out to sea in the wash from the giant tidal wave?
My engineers have assured me their calculations are precise.
What happens if they're wrong?
The expression on Wolf's face suggested that he never considered the thought.
The cataclysm will come to pass exactly when I said it would, and our ships will be safe.
I'm not sure I'd want to be around after the Earth was devastated and most of the humans and animals became extinct.
But that's the difference between you and me, Mr. Pitt.
You see it as the end. I see it as a bold new beginning.
Now, good night. We have much to do.
And he gathered up his sister and walked away.
Pitt desperately wanted to believe that Wolf was simply another lunatic, but this man's passion and that of his entire family went far beyond mere fanaticism.
Pitt stood there, uneasy. No man this intelligent would build an empire worth many billions of dollars to throw it away on a crackpot scheme. There had to be an underlying rationality, one that was too horrifying to envision. But what? According to Wolf's own timetable, Pitt now had only 4 days and 10 hours to find the answer. And why was Wolf so forthcoming about the deadline? It was almost as if he didn't care that Pitt knew. Did he simply think that it didn't matter anymore? That there was nothing anyone could do about it? Or was there some other reason in that devious mind?
Pitt turned and walked away.
He stepped up to the bar and ordered an Anejo, 100% blue agave tequila on the rocks. Ambassador Horn came and stood beside him. Horn, a light-haired small man, had the look of a hawk gliding in a spiral over a forest, more interested in his sovereignty than scanning for a meal.
"How did you and Carl Wolf get along?" he inquired.
"Not too well," answered Pitt. "He has his mind set on playing God, and I never learned to genuflect."
"He's a strange man.
No one I know has ever gotten close to him. Certainly there's been no indication why he would believe in this fantastic story of the end of the world. I've told my colleagues here and in Washington, and they say there's no evidence at all of such an event coming. At least so far. Do you know much about him?
Not a great deal.
Only what I've read in intelligence reports. His grandfather was a big Nazi who escaped Germany at the end of the war. He came here with his family and a group of Nazi cronies, along with their top scientists and engineers. Soon after arriving in Argentina, they established a huge financial conglomerate within less than 2 years, buying and operating the largest farms and ranches, banks, and corporations in the country. Once their power base was solidified, they branched out internationally into everything from chemicals to electronics. One can only guess where the original came from. Rumors say it was gold from the German treasury and assets stolen from the Jews who died in the camps. Whatever the source, it must have been a tremendous hoard to have accomplished so much in so little time.
What can you tell me about the family?
Horn paused to order a martini from the bartender.
Mostly rumors. My Argentinian friends speak in hushed tones whenever the wolves come up in conversation. It's been reported that Dr. Joseph Mengele, the angel of death at Auschwitz, was involved with the wolves until he drowned several years ago. The stories, I admit, sound pretty outlandish. But they claim that Mengele, continuing his genetic experiments, worked with the first generations of wolves in producing offspring with high intelligence and exceptional athletic ability. These children then produced an even more controlled strain, which you see in the extraordinary likenesses in all the third generation of wolves, such as Carl and his sisters, who, by the way, all look identical to their brothers and cousins. One outlandish bit of gossip is that Adolf Hitler's sperm was smuggled out of Berlin in the closing hours of the war and used by Mengele in impregnating the wolf women.
Do you believe all this? Pitt asked.
I certainly don't want to, said Horn, sipping at his martini. British intelligence is mum on the subject. But my embassy intelligence officer, Major Steve Miller, using a computer, has compared photos of Hitler with those of the wolves. As abhorrent as it sounds, except for hair and eye color, there is a marked resemblance in facial structure.
Pitt straightened and extended his hand.
Ambassador, I can't tell you how grateful I am for your invitation and protection. Coming to Buenos Aires was a wild scheme, and you were very generous with your time in helping me to meet Carl Wolff.
Horn gripped Pitt's hand. We were lucky the Wolffs showed up for the party. But I have to tell you that it was a real pleasure to see someone tell that arrogant devil where to get off. Because I'm a diplomat, I couldn't afford the luxury of doing it myself.
He claims the timetable's moved up, but now there's only 4 days until Armageddon. I should think the family will soon be boarding their super ships.
Really? That's odd, said Horn. I have it on good authority that Carl is scheduled to make an inspection tour of his mineral retraction facility in Antarctica the day after tomorrow.
Pitt's eyes narrowed.
He's cutting it pretty thin.
That project has always been a bit of a mystery. As far as I know, the CIA has never been able to get an agent inside.
Pitt smiled at Horn.
You're certainly abreast of intelligence matters, Ambassador.
Horn shrugged. It pays to keep one's fingers in the pie.
Pitt swirled the tequila in his glass and stared thoughtfully at the liquid curling around the ice cubes.
What is so important in Antarctica that Wolf has to squeeze in a visit? Pitt wondered.
It seemed to him that the new leader of the Fourth Empire would be flying toward his fleet in preparation for the big event, instead of to the polar continent. Getting there and back would take 2 days.
It didn't figure.